You are now listening to the Photography Enthusiast Podcast. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Photography Enthusiast Podcast. As always, I am your host, Daniel Lee, or Photos by DOEE. Today we're going to be talking about some AF techniques for sharper images, as long as the usual personal updates and some photography news. As always, to start things off, we'll get into some personal updates. So, been managing to shoot a bit recently. We've had a lot of rain, and this whole week is meant to continue raining, so a certain photo I wanted to do, a certain cityscape, won't be possible, you know, because I don't take my camera in the rain. But otherwise, I did manage to take a self-portrait that I'd sort of wanted to update. You know, if you follow me on certain things, I had that same photo of me hold in front of, like, hiding behind the camera sort of thing for quite a while. A few years now I took that, so I wanted something new to update it with, so finally got that. That also two birds with one stone, because I was doing photos for the RF 50mm review, which is mostly written. I just wanted more photos. I got those photos now, just finished a few things off, and I think I should be able to release within the next fortnight. I just got to record the audio review for it as well. I might release that next fortnight instead of the podcast, just do the podcast episode on that review. See how we go, because I tend to like to keep it purely just a review and no news and that, so I may just do it as a bonus episode either next week or, you know, the week after that, next episode sort of thing. Otherwise, not too much for me, to be honest. Just, yeah, work, games, exercise, lots of exercise, you know, gotta stay healthy. Haven't been eating out as, well, we've actually been eating out quite a bit, but not anywhere different. You know, when everything closed for lockdown, felt like, oh yeah, I miss going here, miss going there. But now that's all reopened, I'm like, don't even miss going to those places. I've got so used to the places I was going frequently during lockdown. They're sort of still just supporting those places. You find, you know, when you go to your same, like a restaurant you really like, the staff will know you, that kind of stuff. No, never any issues with orders, that kind of, you know, thing. Then you go all new staff. It's just not the same experience, not as good, you know. Especially, you know, a lot of places have put their prices up quite a bit as well, so that stops me from going out. Probably wondering how this relates to photography. It's personal update, and also when I go out is when I often take photos. So if I don't go out to take photo, you know, to play new places and that kind of stuff, that means less photos I'll be taking. So it's all related one way or another. Otherwise, yeah, I think probably that's it for me. Personal updates. One thing I'll say is I don't think I covered it with Lightroom. They released all these new updates, so I don't think I covered it in the last forum because I think last fortnight because it came out. But they released these new updates and they changed the way the luminosity masking works now. So they've sort of improved it in a way, but the way they improved it, I can't use it anymore. I do not have a clue how to use it. I knew how to use it the old way, but because the way they've changed it, I think they've included the feathering or something all in one. And I, yeah, cannot use it. Every time I use it, it destroys any image. It's just too harsh. So I got to figure out how to, so they get back to that point where I could do it normally like I could before. Because right now I just have to rely on Photoshop to do all my luminosity masking, since using Lightroom or Adobe Camera Raw both have that same feature. So yeah, it doesn't work. It is more powerful, the fact that you can do it the way they've changed it. And it is good, but it's just more learning. And I haven't seen any really good tutorials on how to use it so far that focuses purely on the luminosity side of things. Most have really focused on the targeted adjustments, because now you can select the subject, select the sky, that kind of stuff, and that's how I've seen every single one focus so far. So I just need to find one that focuses purely on luminosity masking. If it takes me forever to find one and I end up figuring it out myself, I may do a video for TPE, just, you know, editing a photo and focusing purely on that so others can learn as well, because yeah, it's quite confusing for me. So I'm sure there's probably someone else out there that used to use it the old way and maybe is a bit more confused by it now. So on to the actual news. So first up, we have the Samyang 12mm f2 AF lens announced for Fujifilm X-mount. So this APS-C wide-angle lens is compact, lightweight, and features a stepping motor system for what the company promises to be fast and accurate autofocus. I believe Fuji have a 1.5 times crop factor compared to Canon's 1.6, so if that is the case, this would work out to be an 18mm lens, which is pretty good, pretty versatile. It appears to be, according to Pedixel, appears to be the same Sony E lens, just with a new mount built onto it. It weighs 7.51 ounces or 212 grams. It's only 2.3 inches long, but hey, you know, size doesn't matter after all. Weather sealing, yeah, it's got weather sealing, 12 elements in 10 groups. five of which are categorized as special optics, one spherical element, one hybrid aspherical element, and three extra low dispersion elements. These elements combine to reduce aberrations and distortion to allow for what the company says are sharp and thoroughly corrected images. As mentioned before, it has a linear stepping motor which combines a compact design with improved autofocus, a minimum focusing distance of 18 centimeters, and $499. When we look at the exact design of this lens, it honestly is quite a nice design. If this was on the EFM system, I would honestly very strongly consider getting it. Although, you know, it wouldn't be 18 millimeters, I think it would be about 20. See, 12 times 1.6, 19, yeah, so about 20 millimeters. So, well, better than I thought, and my maths that is. But yeah, it does look quite a nice small lens. It looks just like a focusing ring and that's it. I can't remember what the images were like for the Sony when it came out, since it's practically the same lens, but sure, it will have decent image quality. If you have a Fujifilm, you know, X-mount camera, then this may be something of interest to you, especially if $499 is pretty cheap. But, you know, sometimes some people prefer to stick to first party. I understand. I was like that for a long time. So I really guess it really comes down to what you like and what you prefer. Next up is the Samyang 50mm f1.4 for Sony E-mount, which has just been announced as well. So Samyang seemed to be on a bit of a releasing streak here, maybe for the holiday period. But so Samyang has announced the second generation version of its 50mm f1.4 for Sony E-mount. The company says that after 5 years of development, it believes that it has created a new standard for standard lenses. I'm wondering what that means. You know, usually 50mm is considered a standard focal length. So 35 would be wide, 85 would be telephoto, whereas 50mm is a standard focal length. Samyang claims it's the lightest standard lens with a large aperture that is compatible with Sony E-mount and features what describes as more precise and further autofocus performance. It's 420 grams and 3.5 inches long. Once again, size does not matter. 11 elements in 8 groups, 6 of which are special lenses, 2 ultra precision aspherical elements, 3 HR lenses, and 1 extra low dispersion element. Its aperture range is f1.4 to f16 with 9 aperture blades. Nice. Would have been better for 11. I think you can get a bit more circular with 11, but still pretty decent. Samyang's linear stepping motor, STM motor, that the company says allows for performance that will satisfy both photographers and filmmakers. It's got a customizable hold button, weather sealing across multiple points on the lens, and $750. It's kind of funny seeing this lens now because, you know, Samyang used to always add that red ring to their lenses to sort of give it that Canon L lens look, but now they've sort of abandoned that. It's just a sleek black design. You know, honestly, the design of it looks really nice. If this was on RF mount, depending on, you know, further image quality tests, because I've seen some stuff, some mixed stuff, some photos look really good, some, you know, I don't know if it was just the processing that was done on it, but the bokeh does look quite nice as well. No one really seems to know why Samyang just stopped releasing these RF mount lenses, because even when I tried looking for the RF 85mm, I couldn't really find it either. Maybe Canon threatened them with some kind of lawsuit over some patent infringement, who knows. Sort of took like a page from Sony's playbook, like with Sony they, if you don't know, D-Brand made these skins, or not so skins, plates that you can use to attach to your PS5, which Sony got angry about, and D-Brand kept daring Sony to sue them. Sony, you know, threatened them with some lawsuit. They stopped it and they're going to relaunch it now that's more revised again. But, you know, I see it as maybe being that kind of thing. Although not news, Canon rumors did also report that Sigma will address the RF mount in 2022. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. You know, you read so many rumors about what is actually happening with that, who's going to be bringing their RF, you know, if there's even going to be third party lenses on the RF mount. I guess we'll just have to wait and see. I don't know, you know, it would be really good to have some of these Sigma options, because Sigma 35 new 1.4 art, 35 85 art, if they release a 50mm f1.4 art, that would be really, really tempting. Because this Samyang lens is $750, I think it would be around at least 1300 AUD, because our dollar's pretty poor. I think it's around 75 US cents, let's see. So if it's 750 US, that's around 1013 AUD. So as long as the stores don't try and rip you off too much here, which they usually do, probably I'd say around 11 to 1200 AUD for that 51.4, which isn't cheap, especially for like a third party like Samyang. For Sigma, I feel like Sigma can charge that because they've got to the point where they're really established and they're not so much that knockoff brand anymore. They're more of a premium third-party brand. Same goes for Tamron, whereas Samyang's probably like what the old Sigma was with the EX lenses. Either way, we'll see what happens. You know, I really, really like the competition. Prices here in Australia are horrible for most of the camera gear, which I expect to change soon. This is purely just a theory for me, but you know, because of our government in a way, a guy named Jerry Harvey, who owns Harvey Norman, pushed for, allegedly anyway, this is what I read, pushed for that 10% GST because didn't want people shopping overseas, getting all the goods cheaper and never shopping from places like Harvey Norman. Never buy from Harvey Norman. So my theory is that because our borders have been closed, we couldn't travel. It made it even worse because we technically, you know, if we buy online, say from B&H, we get hit with the extra 10% GST on top of that. And we couldn't travel overseas to buy it overseas while we're traveling and then claim the tourist refund scheme, which we get our 10% back. So I think because of that, the prices here have been much higher. Thankfully, borders are opening now, which means we can travel. Joshua also means we can buy stuff cheaper overseas. So hopefully that puts pressure on the local stores here to actually reduce their prices and charge more fair prices. Like especially Canon Australia. Canon Australia has been horrible when it comes to pricing. Even though, you know, I love Canon, I use Canon, but their pricing has been really bad compared to Sony. Sony charge a lot more fairer for their lens pricing compared to what Canon does. Canon here really, really need to get their pricing in check. Next one was OM Digital, which was, you know, previously Olympus, has Mzukio 20mm f1.4 Pro lens has been announced. So this is OM Digital's first product since shedding the Olympus name. The 20mm f1.4 is the first lens to feature the newly announced OM Digital system brand logo and has an equivalent focal length of 40mm on a 35mm camera. 11 elements in 10 groups, design configuration that consists of one super ED, 3 ED, 2 super HR, and 2 aspherical lenses that OM Digital says will provide sharp imaging from center of the frame to the corners and from the window to the wall to the sweat drop down the Olympus's, you know, I'll end it there. 9-bladed aperture design, or diaphragm, sorry, 247 grams, highly reliable level of dust splash and freeze resistance, which works down to -14 degrees Fahrenheit. No clue what that is in Celsius. Probably very, 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 very cold. MSC autofocus system, which is movie still compatible, which they don't specify the motor that is employed in the lens, whether it's like STM, USM, that kind of stuff. Or, you know, whether it's a linear motor or stepping motor kind of thing. OM Digital says the lens offers fast, accurate autofocus in variety of circumstances. $800 and US dollars, I assume, and will be releasing end of December. Quite a pricey lens for a Micro Four Thirds lens. I don't know how much Micro Four Thirds lenses usually cost, so this could be actually pretty decently priced for what it offers. If it's got good corner-to-corner sharpness without coma, I imagine something of this aperture might be appealing to astrophotographers, but I just remember there's a 1.5 crop factor, so I'm guessing 20 millimeters is around 30 millimeters. Let's see. I don't even know. Actually, no, wait. That's 40 millimeters because it's a Micro Four Thirds, 2x crop. So yeah, 40 millimeters f1.4. Well, technically, you know, effective depth of field in terms of bokeh would be different. You can check that on, I think it's MMCalc, Millimeter Calc. They're a really good website for figuring that out. But yeah, that's pretty much that for that one. Next up, so it was pretty interesting. There was sort of a study done into comparing the prices of the Nikon Z9 and Canon R3 around the world. Because as you know, just because this body costs one thing or is fairly priced in one country, it doesn't mean it is in another country. It was very interesting to see. So at the time of this article's publicized, they did both the R3 and the C9, sorry. So with the R3, the cheapest place you could buy it, well, I'll do the top five cheapest places. So China at $5,782, the US at $599, Malaysia 6329, Australia 6463, and Japan as 6560. Now those, you know, the main currency that would stick out to me would usually be the US dollars, because, you know, 599, so that means China are getting it very cheap. But apparently if you look at it on the Nukkeni website, which is the one that did it, you can actually arrange it in different currencies as well to make it even more accurate and more sort of relevant to where you live. Taxes weren't included in the price either, so that could play a, you know, factor depending on where you live. You know, some places like here, and I believe the UK, have very high tax, so that's very different as well. In terms of most expensive, the most expensive was the UK at 8,000 US, 8,031, Norway 7,967, and New Zealand at 7,901, which is pretty crazy. I did figure that New Zealand was pretty expensive because I remember when I went on there on holidays and I just looked at camera gear out of curiosity, all the prices were much higher compared to what we pay here in Australia. When it comes to the Z9 or Z9, cheapest was the US at 5,499, China at 5,626, Canada at 5,938, Japan at 6,126, and the US again, I don't even know how that works, at 6,132. I'm guessing that's with the taxes. For most expensive was Sweden at 7,624, Denmark at 7,486, and Switzerland at 7,477. Now, as you can see, you would expect, you know, the UK to be the most expensive again, which they're 19th most expensive for the Z9 or Z9. So it shows that, say, Canon, Nikon, whoever, they're doing different pricing in each country. It's not fair, which to me is annoying. It should be the one set price. If it's US, this amount should be converted to AUD for that amount kind of thing. It shouldn't be up and down depending on all these other factors, you know? I know people always use tax as the excuse. In Australia here, it's not an excuse because you see Sigma and Sony charge pretty much the exact same price almost as the US dollar. When you convert it to AUD and include the tax, it will be a lot higher. So what you're seeing, the price you buy it for, is not the actual cost price that, you know, manufacturers buy it for. They buy it for whatever price, and then they're adding on all their other profit, tax, all that kind of stuff. So certain countries are being used as cash cows. Australia is one, clearly UK is one. A lot of these places in Europe, Sweden, Denmark, all that, they're being used as cash cows as well. It should not be like that. It should be fair pricing no matter where. They want to get rid of gray markets, price everything the exact same, which I did discuss not that long ago on the podcast as well. The real issue of gray market gear, I can't remember what episode that was, like 45, 46, somewhere around there, I think. But yeah, otherwise, this camera is obviously out of my budget, out of my use. With the R3, I like it, but I don't like the built-in grip because I don't even use a grip on my R6. I've never used a grip before. I like to make my camera as small and as light as possible, not as big and as heavy as possible. It would be interesting what they do with the R1 and if Nikon release something between the Z7 and the Z9. Would they do like a Z8 or... Yeah, I don't even know how they would do it because they seem to go opposite direction to Canon. Canon's the R1's the top body, theirs is a Z9. So otherwise, we'll see how it goes. And the Z9 does look very impressive as well. I think that actually, I don't even know when that came out, whether that came out in the last fortnight, but I believe it did. I should have covered that today. But yeah, next up is the main topic. So as mentioned, today we're going to be talking about AF techniques for sharper images. So sharpness is something people obsess over when it comes to photography. Often, you know, you'll see online people commenting on someone's photo. They wouldn't be like, wow, you got the best. No, this is, some people do, but if you looked at 100 comments, I would say the majority would be commenting on the sharpness. Wow, that's the sharpest photo I've seen. It wouldn't be, wow, your composition is perfect or beautiful lighting or beautiful colors. It would usually be about the sharpness. People love sharp images. I'm one of them. I'm very much into my sharp images, but many people focus on the property of the lens itself and how sharp the lens is, but they don't realize that when it comes to how sharp it is, your outer focus is probably one of the most important factors of it. If you cannot focus properly, your image will not be sharp. So say, for example, back on the DSLR times, if your lens always back focuses, it may be hitting a tiny bit, but that sharpness is not nailing focus, so it will never look as sharp as it possibly could. Depending on what you use, a DSLR, a mirrorless, that kind of stuff, there are some techniques to make sure you're getting the most possible sharpest image. I thought I would go over them. I separate into two categories, DSLR or all systems, or DSLR, mirrorless, and all systems, because some tips are sort of more applicable to anything, no matter what you're using. So I'll start with DSLR. So the number one thing you should do to get sharper images if you're using a DSLR, if your body allows it, and I hope it does, is autofocus micro adjust. I don't know if it has a different name on Nikon or Pentax if you use that, but for Canon, autofocus micro adjust or micro adjustment or whatever it's called on Nikon, it allows you to adjust your camera lenses. So say for example, you have a prime, a 50mm f1.4. Every time you take a photo with this prime, you are noticing it's back focus. So that means it's focusing further back than where it's meant to, or front focus is focusing further. So say for example, you are focusing on someone's eyes, but every single time consistently, they're more like between their eyes and their ears is just their temples in focus, or their eyelash, the very tip of their eyelash is in focus every time, no matter what. Or even if you focus on something else, like a ruler, you're focusing on 0 centimeters, but it actually focuses on further back. Now, two things to keep in mind with this. If you choose the tiniest autofocus spot, it's often a lot bigger than that autofocus area. But when it comes to autofocus micro adjust, what it does is it moves the mirror. So that way, because there's a separate focusing system in the mirror, There's a separate focusing system. With a mirrorless camera, it's all done through the sensor. Whereas with a DSLR, it's got your normal sensor and it's got a focusing sensor. So can often be a miscommunication. So that's where that comes in. In a DSLR, you have the option to actually change that, move it sort of back and forth for that particular lens. So that way it can nail focus. And it's something you should do regularly. I remember when I had my DSLR, I had to do it every 3 months at least to make sure it was up to date, because somehow it would, change a bit over time. There's certain ways you can do it. There's software you can get, plug it into. But the method I used to use was called the dot tune method, which you pretty much using live focus to actually tune it. It was really good method. I can't say I remember exactly the details of it now because, I haven't used a DSLR for like 3-4 years now. But in saying that, from what I remember, you would put your camera in live view, take a photo of something. So obviously have a static subject, like a box or something, really good contrast, really good everything they can focus on. Have your camera on the tripod, focus on that box. Once you focus on it in live view and it's 100% nailed in, you know for a fact it's really sharp. You stitch your camera into manual focus, and then you would just go in micro adjust, and then you dial in something extreme. So say like plus 15, and then you just simply try and focus, hold the focus button. If you get that focus confirmation that it's in focus, then you would know that that's good. So then you can do the opposite and you just sort of get that range. Once you get that range, there's a calculator you can do on the DotTune website that you enter in your values. So say, for example, I'm getting perfect focus up to like plus 4 and plus 4 and minus 4, I'm getting perfect focus. After that, it's clearly not focused. That means that I put that in and, probably be 0, spot on. You just do that for each of your lens and you use DotTune and use live view to calculate what's the most accurate. It works really well and I used to do it all the time, which brings me to the second one. So as I was mentioning as well, just keep in mind with the focus point, that's a bonus one, that even though it's like a tiny box, when you're actually focusing that, it can sometimes pick up stuff surrounding there because it's not as small as that little box is. So it's just one thing you have to do, keep in mind. And then the second one would be using live view. So as I mentioned, live view is just like a mirrorless camera. It focuses with the sensor rather than using that separate focusing sensor. So you're going to have a lot less miscommunication, which helps you a lot. Live view is a lot more annoying because, in one sense, you have to hold the camera out. So for stuff like portraits, it may not work as well. I personally always prefer having the camera up to my eye, but you have to do what you have to do to get the shot right. And if you're on a tripod doing still life, that kind of stuff, there's no reason why you can't use live view. Makes it a lot easier. You can zoom into 5 times, 10 times if you're using, depending on a static subject, that kind of thing. Otherwise, that would be another great way of doing it. And the last way I'd recommend when you're using a DSLR specifically is using cross-type AF points. So those can detect both vertical and horizontal contrast. So depending on what body it is, a lot of the newer DSLRs, all points were cross-type points. So for example, with the original 6D, the center point was the only one that was a cross-type AF point, so the only accurate one. Whereas on the 6D Mark II, every single AF point, from what I remember, was a cross-type point. So you could use either one and it would give you just as accurate autofocus. That's why in terms of when the 6D era, 6D, 5D Mark III, that kind of stuff, when you had less cross-type points, people used to do a thing called focus recompose, where you focus with your center point, which was the sharpest, and then recompose the image. It could work, but if you're shooting at such a shallow depth of field, like paper thin depth of field, that tiny movement and tiny change can easily pull off the plane of focus and you wouldn't get a sharp image, which is something I'll go over a bit more after. But yeah, that's pretty much it for DSLRs. In terms of mirrorless, I'd say the main thing you could do to really utilize your IEF, if applicable, is utilizing IEF. So if you've got a camera that has eye autofocus, you're much better off using it compared to, trying to do focus just with the normal point. IEF makes it so much easier. You don't have to move the point. Just simply hold down the focus button when you've got tracking enabled and compose as you want. In terms of all systems, so this is the main thing I find funny. So I honestly made this mistake and I used to do it incorrectly when I had a DSLR. I would never use servo, and I honestly think that was a lot of the issue with, especially with my misfocus on a lot of my photos. So let me explain it to you this way. Say I am hand-holding my camera and I'm taking a photo of a box on a table. Now that box is not moving, whereas you would think, oh yeah, the box isn't moving, so I'm going to use one shot because the subject is not moving, there's no tracking. But what you don't realize, especially if you're shooting, say at 1.4, even though your box, the box subject, the subject's not moving, you may be slightly moving. Depending on what camera you have, it may not be easy to do this experiment because I don't know how Nikon works. I know Sony does it a certain way. But say you put your camera on a table, then you put that box in front of there. If you go into continuous servo, whatever it's called on Nikon, and hold down the focus button, I know on Canon, if there's no movement, even if it's in servo, you will not hear the lens, you know, focus and recompose, and you won't hear the focus motor moving and you won't see it moving at all. It will just stay static. Whereas if on Sony, when I was using it anyway, it would still keep, you know, focusing just to make sure it would have focus, let go of it, obtain, let go, sort of thing. It would keep rechecking. If you handhold it, say for example, now with my R6, if I handhold something, I can actually hear it constantly focusing because I am slightly moving. You may not realize it, but I am slightly moving. Whereas when I have the camera on my tripod or table and I focus on something, it doesn't do that because it's not moving. So what the point I'm getting to is servo is actually really good to use majority of the time. So the rule is, or the rule I've set that I follow and I never have focus issues is if I am, my camera is static, so it's on the tripod and my subject is static, it's one shot. So single shot AF, whatever you call it on every system, because there's no chance of either one moving. So there's no issue. If my subject is moving and my camera is on the tripod, then would be servo. And then if both, like, you know, my subject static, whereas I'm handheld, would be servo to make up for my movement. Then if both, obviously, my subject and me are moving, like I'm handheld on a tripod, it would be servo again. Because servo is really good. On Canon is an annoying thing called continuous AF. I think it may be on Sony as well, where it just constantly has everything in focus. Even if you're not holding down the shutter button, it'll still focus. That just drains your battery and it's annoying. Your servo is fine. It only continues to track if you hold down the focus button or your back button focus. But use servo or continuous AF or what you call on Nikon majority of the time. The only time you should be using it is if your subject is static, so like landscapes, and your camera's on a tripod. Any other time, servo, servo, servo. With Sony bodies especially, they are designed to work in AFC. They're not really as great in AF like S, single shot. So definitely utilize continuous if you're on Sony. To be honest, even when I have my camera static, I often just keep it in servo because of the fact, like I said, once it obtains focus, it stops focusing. It just sits there, so it's not an issue. And then the other one, I know some people, even if they do have a mirrorless camera, they tend to focus and recompose, which is not needed. With majority of mirrorless cameras, you have coverage up to like 80%, 90% of the screen, so you don't need it. You can focus anywhere, across the frame, not having to worry. Your photos will turn out a lot better. Focus recompose is something that shouldn't be done. Even on DSLR, you're going to get mixed results using it. You are much, much better off just quickly switching and customizing your camera as well. So you can have different focus modes as well, quickly swap. So when I used to shoot Sony, for example, I had one of the custom one buttons or something set to IAF and then just pure IAF. And then another one was set to just tracking. So for example, there were certain scenarios where the tracking wouldn't work. Sorry, so I haven't had the body for like over, nearly a year now, so I forgot how I had. So my main focus mode was spot, like zone focus. So I had a zone. So if I was using normal zone, like I wanted to focus on something, I'd use that with the joystick and with back button focus. But if I knew there was a subject in my screen that I could use eye autofocus, what I would do is I'd press my custom one button, which was just pure eye autofocus. So even if you had that zone up, it would overwrite that and initiate eye autofocus and ignore that. So that way you had access to both zones, like both options of autofocus. So you didn't have to focus or prioritize one or the other, which is a really good way to do it. You can technically do that with Canon. You can change one of the buttons depending on which one you want to use. I usually use the AEB button, the auto exposure bracketing or lock hold button, whatever it's called, the asterisk or something like that, because I shoot manual all the time. So it does nothing for me. But yeah, that's one way to go about it if you do want to, you know, focus across everywhere and have every single focus mode covered. So, you know, you're shooting one thing where you need that zone, shoot that, then quickly move. Or wait, you know, say the bride's doing something, quickly press the other button, and then you're straight in the IAF. Or you can even quickly tap the focus with your first thing to that zone to get that bit in focus. Then once you tap IAF, it's already got that bit in focus. It finds the eye even faster. That's what I found to do. Whether it works for you or not is another thing. But yeah, those are the main tips I would give for sharper AF. It's not really that hard. It's just as if you can try these methods, I'd love to hear if it actually helps you get more keepers, especially the servo one, continuous focus. I honestly think that's something people should be utilizing more, but hey, that's just me. So thank you very much for listening. As always, you can find previous episodes, some reviews, tutorials, all that kind of sweet stuff at thephotographyenthusiast.com. If you want to follow me personally, my blog is photosbydlee.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at photosbydlee. I do go on from time to time, post some photos whenever I post to Flickr as well, which is where I'm usually the other spot I'm most active on. Please make sure to subscribe. If you want to suggest any topics you think I can cover that are not like this camera versus that camera that I haven't owned, you can suggest them in the show notes with the link there. Just Microsoft Forms, that kind of stuff. Don't even need to give your name, no details, just suggest it and that's it. Otherwise, thank you very much for listening and see you later.